either one of these any good?
Wow, this is a good movie.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, well, the director from yesterday doesn't think so.
It stinks.
You're sorry. You waste all our film.
It's so bad.
Welcome back to the Screening Room Podcast. I think we've got a good variety of selections to dig into this week. She is Hope Madden.
He's George Wolf.
And we actually have a special guest a little bit later in the lobby. We're going to welcome in Ryan Turek, the Vice President of Feature Film Development at Blumhouse. How do we score that? We're pretty psyched about it. We're going to talk about their Halfway to Halloween Film Festival that's starting this weekend. So that's on the way, but let's check in with the flicks. The big screen and for streaming, and we'll start with two ancient titans, Godzilla and Kong, clashing in an epic battle as humans unravel their entwined origins and connection to Skull Island's mysteries. It's Godzilla times Kong, the new empire.
We've discovered a signal. She can feel it. Kong. Godzilla, they can feel it too. Something is coming. Something even they're afraid of.
That's a call for war.
Kong can't stop this on his own.
He won't be alone.
You know, in the synopsis there, it mentions Skull Island. Probably not a good idea, and probably not a good idea to remember how recently we loved, and I think everybody loved, Godzilla Minus One, because this movie, in comparison to either of those, doesn't really measure up well.
Does not. And one of the things I think that it doesn't really make too much sense is the title itself, right, which is Godzilla. Well, I don't even, is it Times Kong? X Kong? I don't know what that, but Godzilla gets top billing, which it's clearly, this movie is absolutely a Kong film. They do track what Godzilla is up to now and again, but they've streamlined the kind of tangential characters so that our main focus is the group of characters that hang out with Kong, right? So Dr. Anderson, played by Rebecca Hall, and Dan Stevens is new to the team, the Kong team. He plays a veterinarian named Trapper. And then, of course, Gia, Dr. Andrews' adopted daughter, played by Kaylee Hoddle. She's back as well. And then what they do bring over from Team Godzilla is the podcaster who's played by Brian Tyree Henry. So Dan Stevens and Brian Tyree Henry, they get to add a little bit of levity to the film, which is nice and needed. They also have a really funny rapport between the two of them on screen. They're sort of charming and adorable, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I liked when we first got to know Brian Tyree Henry's character. He was funny. He's been funny in all these. I forget how many he's been in, but the last one anyway brought some. I'm not a nice bit of levity, so I'm glad to see him back.
And then the Dan Stevens character, he. Inexplicably always kind of plays I think they're cassettes of bad early 80s hits like Loverboy, Turn Me Loose and Kisses, I Was Made for Loving You, Baby.
Woo!
Yeah, gems. But anyway, what they find out in Hollow Earth is that there has been a distress signal. There's another big ape someplace, and he's got secret weapons of his own, and there's other kaiju involved. And basically, Kong has to go up to the surface to convince Godzilla to come down and fight with him in Hollow Earth. That's, in a nutshell, the movie and how dumb it is. Now, they can't talk to each other because they don't speak the same language. So Godzilla is very angry, and Kong is frustrated and very like, no, buddy, come on. And then Godzilla, you know, breathes fire on him, and then Kong gets this sort of robot arm. Again, the word is dumb. There's also a baby Kong. I'm sure you've seen that.
Scrappy.
That's right. We get our Scrappy Doo moment. It's, if you just go into it, one of the things I appreciate about this one that I didn't care for in the last one is I felt like Godzilla versus Kong kind of took itself too seriously. This one doesn't. But at the same time, it doesn't ever manage it to be sort of silly fun. It's just sort of dumb. And it feels like a really, 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 really expensive Saturday morning TV show. That's how it feels. That's kind of the sort of ludicrousness that is afoot in the film. There is, you know, the action isn't terrible. The fight between Godzilla and Kong, where Kong is trying to convince him to come back to Hollow Earth with him. I mean, I don't want you to think they're talking to each other. They don't. But that's a pretty fun fight sequence. But it always just feels like a big green screen of palooza.
Yeah, and actually, as fine as it looks, it still made me remember that I don't think it looks as good as Skull Island did. So that's another comparison where it doesn't come out on the plus side. And I sort of got the idea really when I first saw this trailer, because you know we're still even though it's been months, we're still basking in the glow of Godzilla Minus One. And Godzilla Minus One is a film, and so is Skull Island, a film for everybody. I think whether you're a fan of these kaiju movies or not, you should see both of those movies. This one is for the real hardcore fans of all this entire kaiju franchise and every film like it. Otherwise, I don't think it holds up.
No, I mean, there were a lot of kids in the screening that enjoyed it, but it's about as good as it's like an expensive Saturday daytime kids show. I mean, Godzilla Minus One was really a masterpiece and easily the best of any of these films since the original Godzilla. Kong Skull Island was like the perfect popcorn film. They knew what they were doing. They leaned into it.
It looked great.
It did. Yeah. And so you're right. Those are pretty high bars, and this one doesn't even pretend to reach for that. It just kind of skimmies underneath.
But I think what you said in your written review, just adequate fun. Adequate fun. So it'll deliver
that.
Yeah,
it's they don't kiss. I'm sorry if that's a spoiler. I mean, I think we were all hoping they would just make out. I know I was. I was shouting it.
And
but
speaking of spoilers, there's no stinger at the end of the
credits.
That's
right. Don't stick around and wait
surprising.
For something. I know. I was surprised, too.
Surprising.
And disappointed, obviously, that I sat through the whole credits.
But that is in all the big theaters right now. Godzilla Times Kong, The New Empire. Well, let's go to Apple TV next. A documentary that follows the life and career of actor Steve Martin. It's called Steve! Parentheses, Martin, : a documentary in two pieces.
And if you bought my album and you came down here expecting me to do a lot of routines from the record and I didn't do them, well, excuse me!
This guy was getting people so happy.
I always thought, this just does not happen. And it did.
He's the most idolized comedian ever.
He reinvented stand-up.
It was a cultural phenomenon.
I am a wild and crazy.
I always thought of him as the door out of the 60s. You could be silly again.
Steve Martin has just taken the big leap onto the big screen.
I was launched into the stratosphere. My whole life is backwards. How did I go from riddled with anxiety in my 30s to 75 and really happy?
How did this happen?
It's interesting because it's not that long combined. It's about 3-hour watch. But it's really clear and very clever the way the film is broken into two.
Yeah, both the two pieces are so tonally different for a good reason. This is Oscar-winning documentarian Morgan Neville. He did 20 Feet from Stardom. He did the Mr. Rogers documentary. I mean, obviously very talented. And he brings a perfect, perfect plan for this documentary. Because if you didn't need a reminder that Steve Martin is a national treasure, I mean, we say that about Tom Hanks, but man, Steve Martin, and it's great because he's had such a resurgence here in his 70s, in his mid-70s, getting together with Martin Short. And as they bring up in this movie, it's so interesting that he started out as a solo act, and now he's part of a duo, well-loved on the road. And, of course, they've got the show with Selena Gomez that's a big hit. So it's a really interesting career trajectory and an interesting life. And for people that don't remember, I'm telling you, I can tell you because I was there for every second of it. In the late 1970s, Steve Martin was as big as any comedian has ever been. I mean, I know in the 80s, Eddie Murphy was big. I mean, Steve Martin was huge. Albums, and he was on Saturday Night Live all the time, and as many TV shows that could get him. until he moved into the movies. And the first part of this charts his life really from the beginning up through working on his act. And it took him a long time to really hit. It really did. And working up through there and the struggle to find his audience and then finding it. And then part one ends right at the end of his 1979 comic tour into 1980, where he walked away and abandoned that act, that wild and crazy guy, for good. And it's interesting because everybody they talked to, in friends, you know, other comics, Jerry Seinfeld, whoever, you hear their voice and they're introduced with text on the screen. You never see their face, ever. And you're wondering about that until you get to the second part, and it's so much more open and warm and people everywhere and interacting. And that shows, it follows his growth as a person, because early on, that's how he was. And he fully admits that now. And part two gets very touching as he finds now he's got a wife and a child, and he learned to forgive his father. He had some serious issues with his father, trying to get his father's, well, affection, number one, because he said there was never any shows of affection in his house. He talked about one time when he just killed on The Tonight Show, and Sammy Davis Jr. gave him a hug, and he didn't know what to do because he wasn't used to hugs at all. So not only affection, but support for his career and encouragement, saying that he was good at what he was doing, and that was a real sticking point. And that bothered him for a long, long time. And you see him work through that and learn to welcome people in and let people get to know him more. And the way the second part is directed and handled reflects that. And so when you're into the second part, you fully realize, okay, this makes total sense. They should be two pieces. I mean, you can certainly watch them back to back, but if it was one whole, the tone would be completely like, wow, it would be such whiplash. But it's really, really enjoyable. And if you're not already watching Only Murders in the Building, but we love that show. And he's just great. He's a great entertainer, has been since all the way back to the stand-up days. And he started, his first job was selling programs at Disneyland for like a nickel, because he grew up in California. But, you know, if you didn't know that much about his early days, that's interesting too, because it's a lesson in perseverance, because the type of act he had was unlike anybody else at the time. It only happened when he decided to not try to be like everybody else and do and look, you know, cut his long hair, cut his beard, not look like a hippie, try to do something totally different, that he finally started to find an audience. So it's not only a great history lesson about his great career, but a look inside a guy who, like he says, is now extremely happy in his mid-70s when he used to be just filled with neuroses. And that's a happy story, too. Plus, you get Martin Short in the second part.
Which, anytime you can get Martin Short in anything, it's just a jewel.
The two of them together, you cannot help but smile, even if they're just sitting there and not telling jokes. The two of them together are just a joy. And then, I don't know if anybody saw that social media post this week that Selena Gomez put out, just saying what we all knew, that they are both the dearest human beings that you ever want to know. And you're like, well, we kind of all thought that anyway. So definitely check it out. It's on Apple TV. And if you're looking it up, it's kind of hard to find, especially on IMDb. You got to type everything out right. Steve, !! Parentheses, Martin, : a documentary in two pieces on Apple TV. Boy, this next one is interesting. And this is in select theaters now. And New York, 2010. Jeff Harris, a music journalist, sets out to uncover the truth about Francisco Tenoria Jr., a young Brazilian samba jazz pianist who disappeared in Buenos Aires on March 18, 1976. Stars the voice of Jeff Goldblum. It's called They Shot the Piano Player.
I read Jeff's article on the bossa nova rage of the 1950s. I asked Jeff to take things a step further. The story, however, became more complicated.
One day, I came across a name unknown to me. Who's Tenorio Jr.?
Tenorio was one of the top figures of samba jazz during the bossa nova years.
What happened to him?
Very strange story. He disappeared just like this.
Era uma coisa absolutamente estranha.
They stopped a golden age right in its tracks.
Oh.
All that was left were the memories of a handful of people.
I hope this will rescue him from falling into oblivion.
Tenorio did not deserve to be forgotten.
This is weird because I like how we described it on TV this morning. It's a documentary starring Jeff Goldblum about bossa nova music that turns into a murder mystery.
And it's animated. It is a nutty film, and it just keeps you hanging the whole time. First of all, obviously, the soundtrack is glorious. I mean, the music is just so wonderful, so well, you know, integrated into the film. And then the animation style really kind of mimics that. It's just this riot of color and movement, and it's a fascinating idea because you start off with Jeff Goldblum plays, you know, it's a fictional character who is digging into why bossa nova, why was it so very popular starting in 1959 globally, everywhere, New York, everywhere. And then it just kind of disappeared just a few years later while it was at the top of its form. He was really the journalist was looking into that. And as he is doing that, he keeps going back to Brazil to, you know, have a good time and look into his research. And he comes across this pianist in one of the albums that he's listening to. And he just is amazed by his work and doesn't know why he doesn't know this person any better, this Tenorio. So when he looks into that, he finds out, well, it's because he just disappeared. Just overnight, just disappeared. He went out 2 o'clock in the morning to get some sandwiches, never came back. And so the book that he's writing stops really being about this music and starts being about this mystery, about what happened to this piano player. At that point, we start hearing actual audio, old interviews with people who knew this piano player, a real person who was disappeared, right? And then it becomes a look at how this kind of blank, this wave of military coups and fascism and despotism throughout Central America and South America, the millions and millions of people who disappeared. And in this case, the impact that this one, that it had on this music. So he starts off investigating why this musical, hugely popular musical movement lasted for such a short time. One, we find out at the end. It's because they didn't just kill all of these people. They killed all of the art that was coming out. It's a fascinating film.
The director and co-writer is Fernando Trouba. And yeah, this is in select theaters. So if it is in your area, man, fascinating is a great word for it. And of course, there's Goldblum. And that's never a bad thing. And that is out now called They Shot the Piano Player. Well, let's go to VOD. It's Easter weekend. So how about an Easter horror movie, horror comedy? A woman must protect her small town from the jackalope and his army of devilish bunnies as they embark on a murder spree over Easter weekend. This is called Easter Bloody Easter.
What happened?
Bunnies! Bunnies from hell!
Curse you, you gosh darn jackalope!
You know who the jackalope is?
Negative.
Monster's a monster, and I'm gonna kill it.
This is fun.
So hop to the left.
Everybody
shake your little cotton tails on the floor tonight. Everybody! Is that a grenade?
Guns don't kill people.
I do.
I love an Easter egg hunt.
God, you rabbit!
This is nutty. And it's writer Alison Lobel, who's also a co-star, and the director is Diane Foster, who's one of the leads. It's a small Texas town, and their big Easter celebration is still scheduled to go on, even though there's some missing persons and some foul play afoot, especially for Jeannie. She's very concerned, and Jeannie is played by Diane Foster, the director, because her husband is missing. And then her best friend, Carol, played by Kelly Grant, joins in the search, and they come upon their actual tinfoil hat-wearing friend, Sam, played by Zach Canner, who tells about the legendary jackalope, human-sized jackalope, and the army of devilish bunnies that it talked about in the synopsis. And could that be what's going on? And of course, that is what's going on, and it's nutty. They have the tone right from the beginning, that this is very, very wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I mean, there's a prologue that takes a, you know, sends up the very well-worn horror trope of, you know, teenage sex equals death with these two actors that are well past the age of teenager and really overdoing the Southern accent. So, okay, we get it. We're in on the joke. And especially moments when these actual little bunnies, you'll go from actual footage of real bunnies into these puppets, these bloodthirsty puppets. It's pretty funny. I mean, the way it's handled, I mean, I laughed out loud. And so some of the bloodshed is really well done. The cast is strong. I mean, they're all in with this vibe, especially Kelly Grant as Carol. Got some great comic timing. When it falters is when suddenly out of nowhere it starts taking itself too seriously. Like, no, come on, we're digging this vibe, this bloody jackalope vibe. Especially there's a really curious musical segment where Genie, the Genie character, is looking into the mirror introspectively and has this song playing. Like, if this is meant to be funny, it didn't come across that way. It came across as, now we're going to get serious. And that just, it doesn't work at all with the tone. And sort of moments like that inflate the running time a little bit. And you're like, oh, this, one of those where we could shave off 20 minutes and boy, it'd be a lot more fun. But still, it does pack the bloody fun and the just nuttiness, over the top nuttiness. And as long as it keeps that vibe, I think you'll get a kick out of this. And it's on VOD right now. For the Easter weekend, Easter, Bloody Easter. All right, let's stay with VOD for a comedy by writer-director Bob Byington. Man Baby Lousy Carter struggles to complete his animated Nabokov adaptation, teaches a graduate seminar on The Great Gatsby, and sleeps with his best friend's wife. He has 6 months to live. This is called Lousy Carter.
My name is Lousy Carter. I'm a literature professor.
I don't like you lounging out while I'm talking to you.
I have a troubling medical diagnosis.
Sorry about this.
I'm pursuing a grad student.
I'm fine with how you look. I have no, you're not my type, first of all.
Thank you.
This is my stalker.
I was a big fan of the film you made. The animated film from the early aughts.
This is my best friend.
You're the laughingstock of the entire faculty.
I'm sleeping with my best friend's wife.
I feel incredibly guilty. You should too.
I don't feel guilty.
Monster. All your behavior is odd to me. I keep expecting you to sound sort of worldly and professorial, but instead it's more like someone who's somewhere in between 14 and 16.
15?
My ex is annoyed with me.
I'm too tired to argue with you about it.
Everyone is tired. Jesus.
My sister is frustrated.
I wanted to say that growing up, it felt like there were two children, and it wasn't me and you. It was you and Mom.
Tune in to find out what happens to Lousy Carter.
For a comedy on the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, here you go. One of the great things about this, David Krumholtz, who has been, I mean, he has got a ton of credits, a ton. I don't know if I've ever seen him do, you know, just carry a film like this, you know, in pretty much every scene. And he's great. And this is just the driest, darkest humor you could ever find. I mean, this is dry. And if that's up your alley and you appreciate that, I think you'll really appreciate this movie. I mean, I think you can count on one hand the number of times any character in this movie smiles. I mean, everything is just the deadest of pans as he just goes through indignity after he finds out that he has 6 months to live and all these different things going on. Even from his, quote, best friend and colleague, they don't really seem like very good friends. I mean, nobody likes anybody. It's all so cynical and nihilistic, and it's just, why are you guys even managed to go through life? But it's got a great ensemble cast that includes Olivia Thirlby as his ex-wife that calls him a man baby. You see people like Stephen Root. You know, this is
Macon Blair.
Yeah, Macon Blair, exactly. So if you, as long as you know what you're getting in for, that it's very dry and sardonic and just so cynical. There are some laughs to be had, and you'll get to see a really good ensemble cast, including this great lead by David Krumholtz. So if that's your bag, definitely check it out because I think you'll like it. If not, stay far away from it because it knows. I mean, that's the other thing, though. Even if you don't laugh and you stick it out, you've got to give Byington credit for his command of tone. I mean, he does not let up. This is what I'm doing, and I'm doing it all the way through. So if you don't like that, too bad. And so give him credit for that, even if you don't laugh. And I did laugh. By the way, the title, He goes by Lousy. It was an early nickname he got because he's terrible at golf. And that's just stuck. His name's Lousy, and everybody calls him Lousy. And it's on VOD now called Lousy Carter. Let's go to Netflix next. In order to prevent a deadly explosion, an illicit crack team has 24 hours to drive two truckloads of nitroglycerin across a desert laden with danger. Does that sound familiar? It should. The latest remake of The Wages of Fear.
On aimerait que vous rameniez cette nitro jusqu'ici en camion.
Vous avez un peu plus de 24 heures pour éteindre l'incendie.
I don't know if it's sacrilegious, but my favorite version of this is Friedkin's Sorcerer.
It's a great one. Of course, it started in 1953 and was based on a novel. And then in the 25-year, late 70s, Friedkin did it and called it Sorcerer. Both very good and so suspenseful. My Lord. Sorcerer, that one when they're trying to cross the bridge in those trucks. Oh, my God. So this is the latest, and they change the setting, take it out of the jungle now to basically somewhere like Afghanistan, a country like that that's going through a coup. So driving through it is very perilous. There's checkpoints and there's, you know, paramilitary people, and maybe they need paid off. And, you know, you're the group in the trucks here are trying to pose as delivering medicine instead. So that's where a lot of the suspense comes in. Not so much the terrain, although there are a couple of scenes that directly recall scenes you might remember from even the original or from Sorcerer, but they just changed the whole vibe. Now, I will say in the beginning, when I first watched this trailer, I thought, oh man, are they going to give this the Jason Statham treatment? And they really don't. It doesn't measure up to either of the other versions, but it has its moments. I mean, they try to shortcut the character development at the beginning and to let us know why these characters will take this life or death mission. I mean, in the other ones, we knew why. They were at the end of their rope for various reasons. This is okay. You can see why, I suppose, that they're in on this, but they try to speed that up. And sometimes character development, when it's rushed like that, it just doesn't hit as hard, and it doesn't here. And it's not as suspenseful, but it has its moments. And I will say, if you know the first two versions, they changed the ending a good bit here. There's nothing at the end. I wanted to make sure I stayed till the end because I wanted to be sure there wasn't another twist. Because, you know, especially in Sorcerer, there is that at the end with Roy Scheider. There's nothing like that, but they do change the ending. So it doesn't at all live up to either of the original versions. But it has its moments for if you have Netflix for a suspenseful thriller. And that is called The Wages of Fear. This is a French film. So it is. It goes going back to its French roots, of course, because the original was French. So it's subtitled on Netflix starting this weekend. The latest remake of The Wages of Fear. Another streamer, a comedy. A desperate artistic director aims to revive his struggling theater with off-the-wall stage productions, all the while losing sight of why he chose this life in the first place. It's called Early Bird.
Boss, there's a crowd. So many people out there, and I'm wearing this cat suit.
No more cat war after that, I promise.
We're doomed. Look, I've only got 5 weeks left, and I want to do incredible.
The importance of being honest, sink to Ernest goes to jail.
Amazing work.
First, you need to assemble your ingredients.
I'm all tapped out of ideas. So, will you help me, please?
Some of your employees might be feeling a little under. People look at this theater and they think it's a joke. I need more help.
Can I get a raise?
Really? Are you not happy working here? What?
No talking.
I'm fine.
Yo!
Like everyone hates me.
This theater has been your life.
Brandon Thomas reviewed this one for us at madwolf.com. Enjoyed it very much. And you get the feeling right away that it's going to be one of those sort of, you know, on with the show, you know, everybody pitch in and let's just make this last performance the best it can be. And while it is that, it is a lot more than that. You know, when the theater manager, the rent is so high that he knows he can't stay. So as soon as the his lease is up, they're going to have to move out. So instead of doing the same old shows they always do, he dusts off an old weird script of his own, and it turns out to be very popular. So then they're finding more and more very unusual original things, and they start to develop an actual audience. But at the same time, you know, the guy who once was like a humble manager, now he, you know, his ego is blown out of proportion. So the performances are really good, which is why it's as good as it is, because you get invested in these characters and what they're going through. So, you know, it's a streamer. It's a charming movie, especially if you are a fan of theater.
This is writer director Martin Kazubowski. And yeah, it's an interesting take. Another interesting take on art versus commerce. Like, what happens when suddenly the artist doesn't have to worry about commerce anymore, and then all of a sudden they do, and commerce is back in the picture, and how does it change them? So yeah, very, very fascinating look, and one that Brandon recommended. You can check out his full review at madwolf.com, but it is streaming this weekend, starting this weekend, called Early Bird. And we'll close with another streaming documentary. A handsome nerd journeys the globe to turn the conventional art world on its head, set to prove to historians and critics alike that movie props are as important an art form as the greatest paintings and sculptures in history. This is Mad Props.
What is it that makes prop collectors so passionate about owning a movie studio's garbage?
I took the original glove. I just threw it in my bag, took it.
That is what I intend to find out.
This is a real original Gremlin?
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Everything that I love, it's all in one thing.
That one, as you can see also in the shoulder tubes, the shininess on it, that's actually dried slime.
I think in general, film is art, and this is a piece of film, so yeah.
Yeah, this is the size of a car.
Rachel Willis reviewed this one for us. And, you know, I had high hopes for it, partly because of that synopsis. That's not really what it does. Although, you know, it does. It's an interesting idea. And it is really true. Sometimes it really strikes home at how important certain moments and certain films are to you and what it would be like to have Thor's actual hammer or the Holy Grail from the Indiana Jones movie or something like that. You know, it would be crazy cool. But the film, the documentary, loses steam in a number of ways. One is that the documentary itself is not set up in a way. It's not edited in a way. The scenes aren't set up in a way to keep you engaged. It's a lot of the same. Everything looks the same. The pacing is the same. And that's unfortunate. But the other thing is that you find out really, really quickly that all you're doing is hanging out with people who have an insane amount of money to blow on stuff, and you're just looking through catalogs with them. That's not fun. You know what I mean? And so it does really, what it points out more than anything is that a handful of incredibly wealthy guys get whatever they want. That's not a reminder that I need.
I agree. The synopsis had me very interested, and the writer-director is Juan Pablo Reynoso. You will see some faces you recognize, like Robert Englund, they talk to, and certainly some props, some movie props, some movie paraphernalia that you recognize. But overall, not as satisfying a trip as the description had you amped up for. And you can check out Rachel's full review at madwolf.com. But that is streaming now, documentary called Mad Props. All right, let's head to the lobby for our special guest.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
The Schlocketeer taking the week off, so we welcome in the Vice President of Feature Film Development at Blumhouse. He's been executive producer on movies such as The Black Phone, Halloween, and Five Nights at Freddy's. Glad to have him here. Ryan Turek. First off, we want to thank you for trying to make, you know, halfway to Halloween a federal holiday.
You know, I mean, like, at first I was like, wait, this was years ago. I was like, oh, halfway to Halloween's a thing.
It is a thing.
I'll take it because my Halloween decorations are still up. So that all worked out.
It is a thing. It should be a bigger thing. And you guys at Blumhouse, you're doing your best to make it a bigger thing. You've got the halfway to Halloween.
Yeah.
Well, really, it's a film fest all over the country, right? What's going on?
Yeah. It's in 100 theaters, 44 markets, from Friday to Tuesday, this Friday, March 29th. Sinister, The Purge, Ouija, Origin of Evil, Insidious, and The Invisible Man playing out over the course of those nights. And we just want our fans to go and celebrate scary movies in theaters, but also welcome a new generation of horror fans who may have missed those films in their initial run. Welcome them back into theaters and see what they're all about. I mean, like I was just saying to someone else that, you know, someone's first horror movie may have been Insidious: The Red Door, which is now available on streaming. And they probably were like, how did this all begin? Well, go see Insidious back in theaters on Monday, April 1st.
It's a great mix of movies that are just a couple of years old and movies that are a little bit older that maybe people did miss, younger people didn't get to see in the first place. What is it? What do you think makes, for you, what makes a horror movie stand out?
You know, it's so funny because as I get older, the things that really matter to me is like, it's, you know, scary movies that I can rewatch over and over. That's the way it's always been when I was a kid. You know, like I had a VHS copy of Evil Dead 2 that just got worn out. but, you know, for you know, the kind of more seasoned genre bit these days, the things I really look for is like scare me, genuinely scare me and give me a fun time at the movies. And I feel like, you know, there are movies that are obviously kind of more like, you know, poems, you know, and they have a lot of, you know, thoughtfulness and something to say, which is what we try to achieve as well. But give me a ride. Give me something where I'm going to watch someone overcome insurmountable odds against a slasher or a ghost or whatever, you know, and give me a good time at the movies.
Yeah, and we're seeing more and more that a lot of times, thanks to you guys, that horror films are not just for October. I mean, we're seeing them all year long, and they do quite well.
They do. They do. And that's, you know, it's so funny because I think we collectively love to think that scary movies just have only arrived in October. But if you look back, you know, Exorcist was a Christmas movie. It came out in 74. Scream was a Christmas release. And, you know, there have been lots of other films, but, you know, we're kind of in a very good time where horror movies now play front to back, January to December. Let's go. Let's just embrace the dark poetry of scary movies.
And that's really the way nature intended.
That's absolutely right. I mean, like, listen, I'm less than a mile away from someone who still has one of their 12-foot tall skeletons from Home Depot sitting on the front lawn.
Nice.
And they just swap out like the different, every time there's a new holiday, they swap it out with a new decoration. So he's now carrying a four-leaf clover.
That's amazing.
I love that.
Yeah, listen, horror has become a lifestyle. It's become a thing and people have embraced it. It used to be something that was very counterculture and very subversive and punk rock, and absolutely, that should still be at the heart and soul of scary movies. But if more people want to embrace it and find their love in, you know, in that genre, then awesome, great, more power to them.
Do you have an all-time favorite?
My all-time favorite is the one of the first I ever saw in theaters, which was Fright Night.
Nice.
1985.
Yeah.
I saw that opening night with my dad and my grandmother.
It is actually, though, it's kind of a charming movie. I mean, you could have done worse to see something with your grandma than Fright Night.
Yeah. I mean, like, the thing is that movie taught me that movies can not only be scary, because up until that point, it was just you were watching. I was exposed to scary movies through the Universal Classic Movie Monsters and stuff like that, but, you know, a contemporary movie at that time, you know, it taught me that it can be scary, but also very funny. That movie's very funny.
It is funny.
It definitely is. Okay, so Blumhouse and AMC Theaters got the Halfway to Halloween Film Festival this weekend. It's a 5-day festival. Where can we learn more?
Yeah, nctheaters.com/events/ Halfway to Halloween. There's like a little hub. Even if you don't want to type that all in, just go to AMC Theaters. Halfway to Halloween will be a little hub on there that'll give you a breakdown of all the films that are playing as well as the theaters.
Well, that is awesome. It's a great idea. Thank you for doing it. Ryan Turek, Vice President of Feature Film Development at Blumhouse. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Okay, looking ahead to next week, boy, one that we've heard great things about. Can't wait. Dev Patel starring and directing Monkey Man.
Also kind of looking forward to The First Omen.
Yeah, interesting. Cautiously optimistic. One called Wicked Little Letters.
Baghead.
Shada.
Remembering Gene Wilder.
Also one called Glitter and Doom.
And Femme.
That's next week. What about this week? Godzilla, Kong, Steve Martin, Jeff Goldblum. Lots to talk about. We love to keep the conversation going. You can do that easily. You can find us on Instagram, Threads, and Facebook at Mad Wolf Columbus. Also, the main website where you can find all of our written reviews and our other horror movie-only podcasts called Fright Club. That's all there for you at madwolf.com. So enjoy the movies. Have a great Easter weekend, and we will talk again next week. And until then, she is Hope Madden.
He's George Wolf.
And this is the Screening Room Podcast.
See ya.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
Okay, everybody, that's a wrap.